So this framework called the three characteristics is part of the body of teachings in early Buddhism that fall under what we might call kind of inquiry teachings. They are teachings that propose that we look at our experience or look at the world through a certain lens. And in that sense, another word for them, this word is used often, especially in the kind of tantric world, is that they're view teachings. And a view teaching, the first limb of the Eightfold Path is view. View teachings are often thought of as something that the student is given as, in a sense, an initiation almost into the kind of inquiry that the tradition values. So in the Dzogchen tradition, one of the Tibetan tantric traditions, the view teaching is a kind of beautiful, succinct, hopefully mind-blowing explanation or demonstration of the nature of your mind. And then you are supposed to go off and practice that for, you know, years until you have horse's hooves on your buttocks from sitting so long. But you are given the view teaching in the beginning of your practice as a way to say, look for this. And I think some Western practitioners, I've heard from some folks a sense of like that inner process or mystical practice or investigative practice, in a way, you know, isn't it at its purest kind of wide open? Like just look within and you'll see whatever you see. And there's some of that sense in the Buddhist teachings, especially as it evolved into things like Zen, which became very, very wide open in terms of what one might look for. One famous American or Korean Zen teacher who taught in America favored so much a quality of mind that was, in a sense, open and not fixated, that his phrase was, don't know. Always maintain don't know. Right? Someone says, oh, things are this way. You say, I don't know. You say, but things, no, they're really this way. I don't know. And he said, just stick with don't know, and it'll lead you all the way. The early tradition, however, gave sets of very specific pointings out. It said, look at your experience, look at the world, yourself, in these exact ways. And one of those teachings is called the three characteristics. And the characteristics, and it very interestingly parallels, by the way, a yoga or sort of proto-Hindu yoga teaching, also essentially called the characteristics, the teaching of the gunas, that everything has mass, changeability, and luminosity. So the parallel between the two is actually very interesting, which I'm not going to do. But for the yoga people, just to say, you can log in the back of your minds this map of the gunas. The characteristics the Buddha proposes are interlocked. They are all three present all the time in all things that are, the teachings say, conditioned. Meaning everything that came into being based on being part of the whole thing, being part of the ecosystem, this is essentially everything, has this nature. And the three things are, as we talked about last week and the week before, transience as the first characteristic, like keeps changing. My experience keeps changing. Things that I observe keep changing. People clearly keep changing, darn them. And, no, bless them, they keep changing. Both, really. And myself keeps changing. And actually, then, the teaching says, look with some detail at things and say, the things that you think of as consistent, especially the big things like relationships, your sense of self, the world you live in, the things that we assign consistency to. Really look at them. Zoom out, look historically, zoom in, look microscopically, and you see that they're actually constantly changing. The body, the mind, the heart, everything that I think of as myself, everything that I think of as other people, changing. And then the second characteristic, dukkha or painfulness, I like the translation unsatisfactoriness, is simply that because things are so transient, they will not serve us in our search for a permanent, unchanging safety or satisfaction. So there's an implication in this model that, like, somewhere in the heart, in our deep kind of yearning, there's a kind of craving for permanent, reliable safety or satisfaction. This relationship is going to do it. I'm going to be there. Happy ever after. This job, this body, this fixed up body, this political situation, whatever it is, this is going to be it. And then we'll settle down to just having the good life. Never seems to happen. Because no particular thing can be the basis for permanence if itself is not permanent. So no particular thing can be the basis for permanent satisfaction if itself is a transient product of conditions. It doesn't say that nothing gives rise to happiness. Many things give rise to happiness. Good people, good place, good food, safety. Beautiful things. To cultivate, to really give ourselves to cultivating for ourselves and others. But not in an ultimate sense, meaning like eternal sense, what we're looking for. And this whole doctrine arose historically in a time when some of the conversation in the Indian yogas was about the nature of, or if there was such a thing as a kind of permanent essence in things, in individual things. And for the philosophers in the room, that permanent essence is not that different from what was happening at the exact same time across Asia in Greece, and what we would know as Plato's ideals. The idea that there's an essential quality in that inheres in things, that is not subject to its many individual variations, but is somehow transcends those variations and exists eternally. And then later on, the Christian idea of a soul, that each individual has or is an eternal soul in a certain way. These are the concepts that were being chewed on, and spit up, and passed around in the philosophical community that the Buddha was part of. Is there such a thing? What does it look like? How does it behave? How can you describe it? What does it do logically? You know, if one thing has an essence and another thing has an essence, how do they ever influence each other? Because for there to be influence, there would have to be true contact. And if there's true contact, they would have to even momentarily share an aspect of their essence. And that would mean that it's not an essence. Like, those kinds of philosophical questions were rolling around the field. And the Buddha came in with this fairly radical proposition that if you just look, it's an experience-based proposition. He said, just look. Everything's changing. Because it's changing, you can't rely on it. And so then the third of the characteristics is about this essence or soul, or the common translation that I like the least is self, because it sounds too psychological and we think it means our ego. But like, is there a permanent thing called you? Or an archetypal thing called phone or clock or lover or God? that's the same forever. And the third of the characteristics, then, is the absence of this essential quality in things. And it's a very specific absence. This is a teaching that's in certain ways very challenging. The standard translation is not self or no self, which is even worse. The idea is that, you know, you come and the Buddhists are going to say, you know, all of the things that you think of are important are actually not important. And actually, the whole drama of yourself is just an illusion. You don't exist. It's this kind of, this is the parody of Buddhist teaching. And there are really folks who, especially here in the West, where the self or our relationships to ourselves are often so fraught with pain and distress and wounding. This teaching, taken kind of on its own, outside of the context of the entire religion, really, the faith system that would support it, can end up sounding very almost heartless. Like, oh, all those things you care about, like, you silly fool. And this is really, I'm sad about this. This is one of the subtlest teachings in the canon, and one of the easiest to use to either beat yourself up or, especially if you live part of your life on Facebook, others. You know. And I have stumbled into and really tried to find the back door out of as quickly as possible Facebook conversations about the nature of the self, you know, with somebody from the yoga world who's like, you don't understand, like, there is an Atman, and it's the same. It's Brahman. It's God. How could you deny the existence of? And I'm like, oh dear, like we've stumbled into a 2,500 year old, like abstruse disagreement, and actually we're using subtle terms in poor translations. We're talking across traditions. We're talking between religions that didn't talk to each other for 1,000 years after Buddhism dissolved in India and wasn't around for the entire development of late non-dual Vedanta. And we're having a conversation on Facebook, two white yogis being like, you know, or half white, I might get whatever, but, you know, about the nature of the Atman. And I'm just like, this is really bad. But it's actually a profoundly subtle and liberating teaching if we take it very carefully. So a little bit about how we might take it carefully. First of all, in the formula that describes it, it says these are the three characteristics of all conditioned things. All things that are conditioned share these qualities: transience, unsatisfactoriness, and not having an eternal essence, an eternal individual essence. So if we go back to the formula, first we have to deal with this thing conditioned. All things that are conditioned, what does that mean? This is speaking to the theory, really, or natural law, if you want to believe the theory, that underlies the entirety of the Buddhist worldview, which is the teaching on karma, or the law of nature, the law of kind of thermodynamics in a way, that any action produces a result, and that result has something to do with what the action was. Right? The energy of a given action produces a matching result. It's the law of cause and effect in a basic way. So conditioned things means that everything I can attune to or I find in my experience, all of those things, including myself, are, I can see, a product of other things. Right? I watch my baby noodling around the floor And somehow, in a completely mysterious way, I know that, that he's the product of my sweetheart and I, and other things. The great family tree going back forever. Everything that we turn our attention to, it's impossible to take a snapshot of it in this moment in time and say, it is only this right now. The glass that holds this little candle. All I need to do is turn my attention to it and rest into it to actually get that it's a glass. It's a glass that was poured or blown in a factory somewhere, made out of raw materials that were mined somewhere, made by humans in a craft system that was developed. And in the glass, then, so much of the world is present, actually, right? I don't even know what's in there, right? Sand from a mine in one place and you know, water and fire from a fire somewhere, some other place, and who even knows? This is a famous teaching of Thich Nhat Hanh's, who says, you know, in a single piece of paper you can see the entire forest. But actually you can see not just the forest, but the whole earth and the atmosphere and all the rain and all the people and all the plants and everything, because you end up not being able to separate anything from anything else. In the glass is the workman or woman. In them is the food they ate and their parents and the language they learned and the books they read and the poems that nourished them and the rain that falls on them. And you just take that outward until the whole universe is, in the old image, a web completely interconnected. So where's the individual in that? Where's the moment of this glass in that? Right? It flickers by in the great kind of scope of time. Beautiful Thai teacher Ajahn Chah, my grandfather teacher, through Jack Kornfield and others, gave a teaching on a glass, a water glass at one point, picking up the glass and saying, I think of this glass as already broken. And, you know, and the natural response would be something like, oh, that's kind of dark, or like, why would you think about that? And he'd say, oh, you don't get it, you know. Of course I appreciate it for what it is now, but I know the nature of glass. And understanding that it is already broken, he's really saying, understanding that time is really just one way of looking at things. I'm not attached to it. Seeing it as already broken is a way of saying, I'm not attached to it. I've been teaching sometimes in here these phrases that are part of my morning practice called the Five Recollections. And they're just a reminder of this in relation to our own bodies and our relationships, those we love. They go like this. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond death. All that I love, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will be separated from me. I always do these now. I get up with my baby and I let my sweetheart sleep. So we're noodling around the living room at 6 a.m. I light the candle. I do morning prayers. He gets really excited. Whenever I start singing, and he kind of stops playing with whatever and he comes bopping over. But then I say these things, and invariably I'm looking at him, this like cherub laughing at me on the floor. And I'm like, all that I love, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will be separated from me. And it's just true, you know. And every time some part of me goes, eh. Mm-hmm. But it's just true. And but because there's the eh, it's worth saying every day, just to remind yourself. The fifth of the recollections is about the nature of karma, this cause and effect. It says, I am the owner of my actions. Heir to my actions, born of my actions, related to my actions, live dependent on my actions. Whatever action I do, for good or for ill, of that I am the heir. I'll talk about that. I'm going to do karma sometime soon, so we'll go there more. But the sense is one of the lenses on, all conditioned things have these characteristics, transience, unsatisfactoriness, lack of individual essence. That's partly because they're conditioned that they have those characteristics. Right? The conditions are such that they are temporary and all the rest. But of course, the kicker for that third one, lack of individual essence, is not in the glass. I can deal with the glass breaking. Like, it's okay. Right? I can even kind of deal with, my cherub growing up. Partly because, I see it happening all around. It seems to be how it goes. People seem to survive their children growing up. So that seems real. But the great kind of delusion, the veil that's so hard to pierce through. And the Yoga Sutra says, clinging to life is instinctive even for the wise. The great veil to pierce through is the illusion, no matter how much we know it intellectually, that I also am transient, incapable of permanent satisfaction, and not containing a permanent essence. And what is the I, even to say, I am that? What it really means is all conditioned things. So what is that? That's the body, for sure, right? We already did that, first three recollections, old age, sickness, and death. So it reminds us the body is subject to these conditions. But what about the mind and my sense of self, my subtle sense that I'm the little guy riding the big wheel down Helen Way, and I'm the guy who had the plastic Millennium Falcon in 1977. It was so cool. And I'm the guy who, recorded every episode of Doctor Who from 1963 to 1984 on VHS tapes and had them categorized by season. Is that me? Am I that guy? Right? The body has replaced every single one of those cells many times over at this point. Who is that guy? Constantly changing. None of those identities gave rise to lasting satisfaction, although they all had their moment. And then we look at our thoughts. Right, that thing that seems to tell the story of ourselves to ourselves over and over. And part of the investigation that I offered in the sitting was to sense whenever the mind wanders or perception goes to some other thing, that what it goes to is in a certain way a reflection in a mirror. And the mirror is consciousness. This is an old metaphor from the Buddhist and Hindu yogas. The mind or consciousness or awareness is a mirror. And what it shows is myself. In little momentary flashes. And this is what Patanjali says is a mistake. The Buddha just says, show it to me. Show me that self. Find it. My mind wanders to, a thought of my kid. And embedded in that thought is like, a selfing, we call it, or like a becoming. Oh, I'm the father. Oh, he's my son. Oh, he's beautiful. Oh, I'm proud. Oh, I don't have a job anymore. Oh, I'm scared. Like, and it just sort of, and to the extent that I don't discipline the mind back to the breath, that will just keep going. And it will just keep kind of telling a narrative. I'm like this. And mind goes, oh, my hip, my leg is falling asleep, my hip hurts, oh, the hip hurts, Oh, my hip's been hurting for 20 years, maybe I won't be able to sit for a minute, I'm getting older. Again, it's a perception, there's a flash of sensation. But the mind, even without doing it in words, makes a little story about it. Even the simplest story that goes, my hip, my hip, my hip. It's the my that kind of rings in the mind like a bell. My hip, my phone, my son, my country, my politicians. And of course, if the story is not about my, but it's about them, it's still a story about you. those evil politicians, those other people, the beloved that I can't have, the beloved that I want, the beloved that I got and now isn't who I thought they were. The whole story goes around and around. The beloved that I have and am madly in love with, my beloved, I am their beloved, I am their. And all the stories are that. All of the perceptions even are that. And when the Buddha breaks this down, he says, look very closely at this. All of those things spill out from one basic perception, which is the perception of liking some things and not liking others. That's the first turn of the mind when there's a perception of anything. I like it. I like it. I don't like it. I don't like it. Right? And there the self appears through a lawful process. Lawful meaning through a karmic process. The self is conditioned by our reactions to things. Right? I have a thought, this would be a good moment to quote Shakespeare. Where did that come from? Well, Shakespeare is part of my mind because I'm part of this culture. Do I own that? My education? No. Right? Totally inherited. Everything turns out to be inherited, pretty much. So then this is the part that's scary about this teaching, is folks say, oh, you are in fact suggesting that I don't exist. Nolo contendere, but guilty as charged. But it's actually not a tragedy. This is very good news. Right? If I was still the guy who was obsessed with getting every episode of Doctor Who in order, really, like, that was very nice, but it got old. I got older. Right? If I was really the guy obsessed with getting a kiss from beloved ex on the dance floor, like, boy, if that particular yearning lasted for 25 years without a break, that would be misery. It was misery as is, until I got it, and then it was bliss for about 3 seconds. And then I wanted something else. I wanted. The danger in this teaching is that it's a deconstructive teaching. This is the danger in this whole realm of view teaching. And that now warrants what we've learned is actually a contraindication in our culture, maybe in other cultures as well, which is that this teaching, even though it's central to the inquiry practice in some forms of Buddhism, is not a neutral or safe teaching for folks who have suffered profound trauma, some kinds of attachment trauma, some kinds of developmental trauma, some kinds of wounding or shock trauma, where a strong sense of individual self is absolutely healthy. Right? It's also not appropriate at certain just phases of development. If you told me, at age 7 with my Millennium Falcon, that everything was conditioned and, this too was just a figment of the cultural unfolding, I would have been like, what are you talking about? I love Han Solo. I kind of am Han Solo, And that identification would last for, 20 years or so until I could get into Facebook conversations being like, people, Han shot first. It's okay. Right? We don't have to make him into a kind of saint. I always knew he shot first. That whole thing was bullshit. Right? That's identity. Right? That's like, okay, I carried that identity. And at some point, like, all right, it's fine. Right? It goes. So the teaching on not having a permanent essence is not a teaching for children. It's not a teaching for those recovering from abuse. For those in extremely oppressed communities, it's a mix, right? It could be really liberating to say, actually all of this is systemic, including even your sense of self. Internalized oppression is a kind of selfing based on conditions that are external to me. So that this could be a liberating teaching for some in oppression dynamics. In others, you know, the sense of needing to have a strong identity. This is my affinity group, my identity. That's a wholesome maneuver. So it's a delicate one to be offered delicately. I'll finish just by saying it's subtler even than I've discussed with you. When the Buddha would be asked, Gotama, just tell me, like, do I have a self or not? Just straight up, tell me. In multiple discourses where the Buddha was asked this, in one of them he just gave the questioner totally the silent treatment, like refused to say a word until the questioner went away upset. And the Buddha's assistant said, Blessed One, why didn't you answer? And he said, well, if I'd said there was a self, he would have gotten the wrong idea. If I said that there wasn't one, he would have gotten the wrong idea. There wasn't actually any way to give this particular person in the state that he was in a response that would have led to wisdom. You know, he'll come back. At a different time, he gave a different response. But in no particular time did he say categorically there is or isn't this thing. And I think that's because he wanted us to take it not as a absolute truth, but as a practice. Just look for it. You know, actually ask the question about each of the things that you so identify with or crave or covet. Could this be that? The sense, the soft, pervasive sense of being me. Could this be that? And just observe it. Does it say the same? Does it give you what you wanted? So because this is a liberation teaching, I'll end with a poem, a liberation poem, about... beginning with a reflection on karma, cause and effect, and a moment of doubt in the heart of an advanced practitioner, and a moment of liberation. This is the enlightenment poem of the nun Patachara from the early women's community. This is a bit of a paraphrase. She says, young Brahmins and landowners sow their seeds in the earth and gain the fruit of their labor and the crops. I've practiced hard. Why have I not found freedom? I washed my feet and watched the water pour down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. I went into the hut, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. Let's just take a moment to sit together. So thanks for listening warmly, kindly. We have time now for other voices, reflections, curiosities, your experience, questions.
I just always feel myself very resistant whenever I hear this.
Indeed. Indeed. Yourself is very resistant, is it? Is it?
Yeah.
What does she think about this?
She thinks that. Well, one thing was, like, I got kind of caught up in the language, but it's kind of the same. I realize it's kind of the same, like, argument that I'm having about value.
Mm.
You know, of, like, that if you say, like, oh, there's nothing that you can own because it's all inherited. I guess I'm thinking because it's not like an original thing, because it's not your original self.
Yeah.
And so there's like a lack of, there's something that's not to be cherished as a self because it's not the original thing, because right. I am...
Like the mind makes this leap from, if I can't own it, or if I don't own it,
it
then somehow it's hard to cherish it, or...
But I do own it. I own it.
You own it. You totally own it. It's you.
I didn't create it or make it. You know, I recognize myself as like the kind of a gathering of all of this material, you know. But I own it.
Yes, you do. You absolutely do.
And I live through it. I live through it.
Yeah.
You know, and I experience and I feel, you know. And
absolutely,
so,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then the other thing was when you said the sense of being me, and I was thinking of the difference between, like, the sense of being and the sense of being me.
Nice. How do they feel different to you?
Well, I guess I'm more caught up on the sense of being. Like, you know, I'm really into, like, being. Like, what am I feeling? You know, what am I experiencing?
Yeah.
Like, the being me sounds a lot about, like, defining my identity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right. What if that's a really useful or sweet distinction in this realm of inquiry? To say, like, oh, what if the being me is almost, like, too narrow in some way, too define-y, but that this being, feeling, experiencing, kind of being in the flow of that, is more expansive, more freeing, more vibrant than this kind of defining myself as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? The voice from...
I don't want to interrupt. But I do want to echo Nina's question, another question. In a way, I think this question has to do with the kind of psychologism that we come into in the culture in which we exist. That is, and you limbed this in your talk, the degree to which, when we hear self, we mean a particular kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? And I wanted to sort of ask, and maybe we're on the same wavelength, you know, I'm not sure. For me, it's very confusing to try to sort out what this tradition is telling me about selfhood, because I am so encumbered by my own baggage about what those words mean and what it means to build myself up, either in response to some kind of inchoate trauma or simply because that's what I've been taught to do.
Yeah.
And I was just going to ask if you could say more about the possible other renditions of self here.
Truly. I feel like I even started the talk with the, almost like, by saying I don't like the translation self. And then it's so the common translation of this thing that I almost revert to it without knowing. I much prefer the translation's essence or soul. Self was given to this concept, Atman or Atta, by the German theorist of religion, who kind of founded the discipline of religious studies, Friedrich Max Müller, in the mid-19th century, and he gave itself, and so and I actually don't remember what he gave it in German, but it turned into self in English. Right. So it wasn't das Ich that would later be a problem with Freud, but there is a whole historical kind of unpacking of how the term self was assigned to this thing. But when we, the reason I mentioned Plato in the beginning is that when we read the early texts describing this and this whole conversation in the Buddhist and Upanishadic and other places, conversation about what this atta or atman is, there's, it doesn't carry any of the sense of a kind of thing with qualities like a personality. It doesn't even really carry the sense of identity as a, like, the you-ness of Nina, which is so distinct and unique and real. It almost says on an underlying way, in the way that we could have a conversation back in the sort of kind of solidly Judeo-Christian context, we could say, you know, the nature of the soul, your eternal soul, you know, meaning that there's, like, If we embed it in the concept of rebirth that arose kind of roughly around the time of the Buddha, give or take several hundred years, it doesn't appear in the earliest Vedas and kind of grew in. Plato also believed in it. The idea was, you know, that this essence ran through many, many, many different lifetimes where you would have many different personalities, many different groups of interests, many different stories, many different influences. So all of that stuff, even my identity, is more surface than this fundamental quality. So essence sort of hangs in there as my current sort of favorite, partly because soul is also encumbered with baggage. But essence isn't perfect either, right? It's something, you know. It's almost like there's an idea. And because of this, some modern texts just leave Atman untranslated. They say, like, deal with the Sanskrit word because translating adds a whole other layer of obfuscation.
If you don't mind,
please.
It also sounds like the question: is there such a thing as the unconditioned?
Indeed. So. The lacuna in the set of all things that is conditioned is the single thing that the Buddha called the unconditioned. And this is the reality called extinguishing or cooling or nibbana or nirvana. And the word nirvana refers to the blowing out of a candle. So that final poem of Patachara, this is the one of the earliest images of liberation is what happens when you separate the heat of the flame from its fuel? Well, the flame goes out. Where does it go? It doesn't go anywhere. It didn't ever have independent existence. It was completely real, but it was a result, it was a karmic result of the contact of heat and fuel, which in humans is craving and sense objects. The heat of craving meets the sense object called the desirable or feared object. And a certain fire, called suffering, burns as long as it does until you separate the heat from the fuel. And when you do, that craving goes out. Along with it, the belief that the self is something other than it is, or that I am something other than I am. It just becomes obvious that things are the way they are. And all of the other stuff, my identity, my preferences, and things, seem generally to remain. The teachers and senior students who describe these experiences, they're like, that was completely profound. I totally know that I am not what I thought I was. I still prefer pumpkin curry over all other foods. I'm still kind of a jerk when I'm sleepy. And, you know, et cetera. And I still think Han was, you know, whatever. So, like, the personality seems to remain. And the identity seems to remain. You know, people who are gay and get enlightened are enlightened gay people, as in every example that I know of, right? So all sorts of layers of who we are, even very deep layers, aren't actually touched by this the liberation from this idea of a permanent essence. But something changes. Other thoughts here? Please.
I guess I have a word that I've been using lately.
Please.
So, you know, when you see, like, I think of a blade of grass amidst blades of grass, and I go, you know, what is it in the that makes this blade of grass stand upright and reach and grow toward the sun? And what there's something that at some point it's not in the blade of grass, and the blade of grass begins to disintegrate. And it's the same something that's in a deer or in me or in anything, and I call it life. And so that's one way, one vain attempt to name what is unnameable.
But
one way that I look at it, and again, I know I still get all caught up in my sense of self, because it's a tricky, very subtle thing. Even saying
that yours is too.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It's like part of me, I'm even hesitant to say anything because I know that my sense of self will go, oh, I'll say something, and then my sense of self will be bolstered, and you know, so it goes counter to everything I'm trying to say. It's that life that is undying.
Yeah.
And what we do as people is we go around and we're so convinced we want to hang on so tightly to saying, I am the blade of grass. I am this blade of grass. I am this form that life has taken.
Yeah.
And so I'm hesitant to ever even use the word soul, because sometimes it's like a psychological way of going, oh, cool, now I can be this self beyond this life.
Totally.
And really hang on to it. When really, and until we come to know ourselves as life itself, without any individuality or without being identified with the aspect that changes the form that it takes,
then
we're still mistaken around who we are. And so in that way, it's one of those things where it's like there is something that, I mean, I still think you kind of got to let go of everything, but there is something that prevails.
Truly.
And so, which makes me think of Obi-Wan in... exactly. So, and his knowing in that. So that's kind of my. And I use the word life in that way. It seems like an easy English language word to play around with, or the force or whatever.
Yeah.
We want to name it.
Absolutely, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful way. I love hearing you say it, and you know,
something. But it's
there is, and it's a great way of saying that there's something that persists, like between lifetimes or whatever it is. Folks would ask the Buddha, you know, now that you are the one thus gone, the Tathagata, his name for himself, do you exist after death or not? The great question about after death, right? Because if we're connecting with something that persists, and the idea is that life, at least, existing, has persisted through all these lifetimes, what happens when the liberated person dies? And he would call that question one of the inconceivables, which I will always say is my 80s mod band, the Inconceivables, but the four Inconceivables. But he would say, to say exists isn't correct. To say doesn't exist isn't correct. And in some way, you know, we could come back to, again, thermodynamics that says, you know, energy is never created or destroyed. So it just changes form, right? The life layer to the flame question is that, of course, the flame as a thing that we can see and seems unified disappears. But actually, what it just does is it reverts to heat, right? It disconnected from the fuel, its heat, its light dissolves into the surrounding light, and its heat dissolves into the surrounding objects. I take a little bit of it into my hand, and for a moment just sort of blossom in the pleasurable experience of heat on the palm, and then it's gone, you know, and then it passes into my body as life in another form.
Becomes the sheet of paper and...
Becomes the sheet of paper and onward the whole thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful word for it, I think, not just in a poetic way, but really in a very literal or logical way, as to what they were speaking about with that concept.
Right. And I appreciate the don't know thing, you know, because it's like I can feel the hesitation to even say anything about it because it's so easy to want to grasp into some sort of knowing and.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's always good to put a footnote of don't know and non-self in any Buddhist conversation, really. The only problem with life, of course, is that it's part of a dialectic with death. And so then it, in a sense, asks us to confront once again our perception of what death means, which I think is a good thing, right? It's like, oh, is life actually the opposite of death? It's not actually. Birth is the opposite of death. So then life is the opposite of what?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and then we get into the don't know question of the Tathagata. We're just at about out of time, but Catherine, you blossomed slightly a bit ago.
Well, actually, I was thinking that I was maybe going to ask you to pull this, because I wasn't here the last two times to hear about suffering and changeability, but this idea came up sort of along Nina's lines of, or the feeling came up for me that I was like, oh, maybe this is actually not about non-self, but the experience of like accumulation of like bad affects, like regret, self-loathing, these things of just like, it would be so nice if I just had, like if I could get out of this self.
Yes.
And it's like this like pushing against.
Yeah.
About everything that I feel I am, which isn't necessarily my personality or what I like, but this, it's actually so, it can be so physical if it gets kind of spun out of control.
Yes.
But then I was thinking maybe that really does have to do with these other characteristics that you were describing.
Well, they're all, right, they're all interwoven, but, right. But this is a, I think this is a wise turn of the lens to say, let's not get caught up in abstract sort of intellectual arguments about the nature of the self, but what actually happens? Oh, I have these, you know, painful affects, painful feelings, you know, of regret or doubt or, you know. And that's actually what, that's just suffering, straight up, you know. And the teaching on things being, you know, transient and not having a self partly just hints to us the suggestion that we might not so easily believe that those things either are as lasting as they think they seem to be, or that they actually define us in any way. You know, they certainly don't impact our aliveness. They're if anything, they're just a manifestation of that aliveness that we don't happen to like. And we can change our relationship to them, and we can practice, you know, and being in wholesome states and just diminish their frequency.
It seems to me it would be an easy error to make then, in that when, if you're sort of, if those feelings arise, to then turn towards this idea of non-self in those moments, because it's not quite...
It would.
Because it looks like an escape route or something from that, or like exactly what it is that you're looking for.
Yeah. Okay. It would be a mistake. Okay. And the standard word is spiritual bypass for that.
Okay.
Right? It's like, oh... you know, it's okay that all my relationships are dysfunctional because, you know, it's all one, right? Calling on a not-self teaching to make it possible to not work on my or not see clearly something is a kind of bypass. And then it would be like, you know, it's not you, but your room is still dirty. You know, anything else? Any other flames burning that must be extinguished before we...
Just
To me, this room is already clean.
The room is already clean. Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally.
I can imagine it being clean.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 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 So I hope, you know, that my 10-year-old at some point, if like, Yasa, you know, please, like, I really love if you, like, just clean your room, pick up the toys, and he'd be like, can't you see that the room is already clean? I would just be like, my son, it's my son. I'm so proud. Yes. Truly. Truly. Thanks, everybody, for being here. It's such a pleasure. As always, we manifest in this group the resistance that we can against an inhuman capitalism, and we function fully on gift economy. Your gifts and generosity, the use of your resources to support this group, are profoundly necessary and helpful in keeping it going. So thank you for your generosity, and get shared between the studio and myself, and make it possible, of course, for those without resources to be here as needed. So I'm around next week. We'll swing into a new, you know, sub-narrative in the ongoing soap opera of this. We'll figure out something to talk about next time. Maybe we'll talk about karma. Maybe we'll swing back into, you know, social justice or something. Don't know. But I'll let you know when I know, which will be next week. So, blessings, and see you soon. There's an email list for emails over there. We're collecting a fresh email list just for this group so that I can send you special notes and not the other riffraff that get my notes to say things like come and have a picnic or things like that as we start to do things really just for this community.
I have to tell you something.
Please.